Explain gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Lots of things to think about this morning. Hey, take a look at your banana. Take a look at your banana patch, okay? Let's just go to this banana patch real quickly. Take a look at that banana patch. If you're lucky, you didn't cut it all down last November, December, when you got your first frost, or in January. You didn't cut it all down. You've got a lot of trunks left. Here's the thing. Each pad, each little colony, each group of bananas that come from the same clump, in order to get good fruit out of that clump, you want to have right now a trunk that is about 7 feet tall and actively growing, and preferably hasn't actually started producing a fruit yet. That's going to be perfect. That is going to be perfect for making good fruit this year. 7, maybe 8 feet tall would be good too. But you don't want to have 15 of them in the same pad, because that means they're all going to compete with each other for nutrients. That means that they're going to be slower to start producing fruit. So if you have 15 plants that are emerging, you want to cut all but one to two of them down. Okay? That's the key. Just cut them down, leave them right where they fall. If you like, that's probably the best way to do it. And let the one that you want the fruit to come out of, let that one go. Now, it helps to fertilize it. It helps to water it. All those things help. But it's just really important this time of year to not have too many bananas if you want to have bananas from those plants. And the chances are very good you're going to have a great crop of bananas if you just think about that and follow through. Okay? There it is. So, David, this is just an interesting question. And you're calling from San Francisco, of all places.
Oh, yeah, but I'm hazardous waste, spread all over soil. Like, they had the big hurricane 2 years ago over in Houston. And yeah. What I'm wondering about is various kinds of plants that can sop up the hazardous wastes out of the soil so you can start to, grow a garden again up in there. And if I remember right, cattails, they'll pull lead out of soil. I think bamboo does too, although, bamboo can be pretty invasive. But if you had an oil slick, or if you had hazmat, over in Houston, the hazmat is a real deal, because they had the Houston Ship Channel, and when they got 50 inches of rain, that flooded all over, all the way down to the Gulf Coast, and so you can't trust what's on the shore anymore until you get that sopped up. So I'm wondering if if there different kinds of plants that'll sop up the hazmat.
Yeah. Well, I do. And what's interesting is, of course, what is hazardous? And there are a lot of different plants react in different ways to different minerals. Some are quite good at absorbing those minerals, and some aren't. Let me talk a little bit about contamination. We don't need a hurricane to have a lot of contamination in soils. We use lead paint and lead in our gasoline forever. And so a lot of soils have tons and tons of lead in them, whether San Francisco or Houston or Mobile. Lead is very common. Arsenic has been used a lot in the environment. We used it as a poison in cotton fields and in around pecan trees. So arsenic shows up a lot. So there are a lot of contaminants in soils. And I often think about and worry a little bit about how much of that is taken up by plants. Let me start off by saying that this is not a solution to every contamination. Some contamination is more than you can deal with, and you've got to go in and you've got to actually remove the contamination. But organic matter usually helps to tie up a lot of the bad stuff that's in soil. So if you have enough organic matter in your soil, it ties it up in such a way that it is not as available to humans, it's not as available to groundwater, and it's not available to plants. So that's one way of doing it. The other thing you have to remember is that a lot of toxic metals don't dissipate. I mean, they're elemental, and so they take on different forms, but they never really disappear. So you can't really break down mercury. I mean, mercury is already broken down. It's an element. You can't break down arsenic. It's already broken down. It's an element. So those things, but what you can do is you can tie them up. And having plenty of organic matter in the form of leaves can make a ton of difference. So if I had soil that I was worried about, that had a little bit of contamination, or I just wanted to be careful, the one thing I would do is put on a thick layer of organic matter where I wanted to garden and where I wanted to grow vegetables. And that's what I do. Because I have a yard that's in an old neighborhood, and there is no telling what went into that soil, and the organic matter solves it for me, for the most part. What's interesting is that the plants that absorb toxic minerals are the plants that we often eat. And this is kind of scary, but for example, brassica, the members of the mustard family are very good, extremely good at absorbing lead and absorbing arsenic and some, well, not arsenic, but lead and mercury. And they can absorb those two compounds very readily. A lot of fruit trees will absorb mercury too. It's that they can all be very good at it. So you want to be a little bit careful, and that's why I say it's really important to make sure that you have the organic matter, because a lot of times it's the plants that we eat, like these mustards, that are actually really good at absorbing those chemicals. If you use them to absorb chemicals, then you have to figure out, how do I get rid of these plants? Because they have absorbed those toxic metals, and they themselves are hazardous waste. So it's tricky.
That gets into cattails. If I remember right, people used to, you remember you had chairs, wicker chairs, things like that. And if I remember right, you know, both bamboo and wicker, cattails used to be used for just making chair cushions. So that would work out, except you just don't want to burn it. If you ever got a hole in your chair, you don't want to toss it in the fire, I guess.
That's right. Well, and of course, that does happen. When plants burn, they do release mercury quite frequently. Boy, we're getting way in the weeds here, so to speak, but the cattails, you were only using the heads to stuff those cushions with. You still had most of the stem, so you had to figure out how to do that. I would say that phytoremediation, trying to get rid of minerals with plants, is probably not a great idea for a home brew situation. I would recommend the organic matter route, and really building up tons of organic matter. It's the best. It's probably the best way to be safe, is making sure that you have plenty of organic matter. And I'm afraid I would bore people if I told people why organic matter was so good at doing that, but it is very good at it, particularly in sandy soils, where things don't get tied up very well. So
yeah, here things are wrapping up. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, David. That was a challenge. It was good. Good question, though. And something we often don't talk about is the toxic stuff that's in our yards. I wouldn't encourage you to panic about it, but I would encourage you to be aware of it. It's why I don't recommend never plant a food plant within 3 feet of your house, because particularly if your house was built before the 90s. Because it's almost certain to have lead in it. If it was built after the 90s, no telling what's in that soil, because it was all pushed off when they were building the slab or whatever else. Move your plants 3 feet away from the house, and you're much likely to get into a contamination hazard. Something to think about. Another reason I say Don't plant plants within 3 feet of the house. Hey, we'll be back. Give us a call.
If it keeps on raining, Levy's gonna break. If it keeps on raining, Levy's gonna break. And when the levy breaks, I'll have no place to stay.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. You know, boy, that's a tough one. Sometimes thinking about our soils and the things we've done to our soils without even thinking about it. But it can, we can have some big problems, you know. One of the things that distresses me is how much I love rice. I love rice, and I love rice from I love the Southeast. It's something we've grown here for a long time. But you know, one of the interesting problems is that a lot we used arsenic very heavily in many of the fields where we grow rice in the Southeast, and we used the arsenic to poison boll weevils for cotton or whatever else, and there was runoff. And that arsenic just doesn't go away, but it does get mobilized when you're growing rice, and it does get taken up into the rice. So arsenic levels in rice, in some cases, were pretty high, and it's something you should think about. It's one of the ironies is that when people decided, oh well, wheat's a bad thing, we're not going to feed our babies any more wheat. We're not going to feed wheat to our children anymore. Because, you know, somebody, okay, we won't get into that. So instead they started feeding them rice, and suddenly we started seeing children with high levels of arsenic because of the high levels of arsenic in the rice. It can be tough sometimes, what we've done to the environment. And we've done it in some subtle ways that I just don't even like to think about. One of the things that happens is, and it does work pretty well, If you have known contaminants in your yard and they're at serious levels, don't fool around with it. You're going to have to get an expert to do it. But if you're a little worried about toxic minerals, you don't have any toxic heavy metals, and you don't have any evidence that they're particularly bad, organic matter helps a lot. It makes a big difference. And particularly in, you know, there are many reasons to have organic matter, but if you're gardening in an area where people have been living for a long time or farming for a long time, organic matter can be pretty important in tying up those heavy metals that we've added to the soil. That's enough on that today. Just wanted to follow up on that. Hey, is it Wanda? Is that right?
Yeah, Wanda.
Wanda, I'm listening. What's up?
Well, look, I've seen some long 3-inch worms with lots of legs running around some of my azaleas. Okay, stopped seeing them, and then I've seen these lumps, like dirty mashed potatoes, about a tablespoonful, in different places in my azaleas. And they're hard. One fell off, and I picked it up, and it's like a hard lump in amongst the tender leaves. Is this caterpillars doing their thing, or is it some kind of cancer or something on my azaleas?
Well, isn't that interesting? Now, describe it to me again, because this is a—I haven't heard. This is—it's a white oatmeal-like lump.
It looks like mashed potatoes, and it comes in different colors. Some of them is like white with brown, dirty-looking stuff in it, and some one or two even had like a pink cast to it. So I
has a pink cast, yeah.
Caterpillars getting, you know, doing their little cocoony thing, but it doesn't look like that. It looks like dried mashed potatoes.
I'm listening, and I'm looking for the best way to describe these things too. And the mashed potatoes is an interesting thought, Well, they're kind of hard though. They're hard. They're not like mashed potatoes because they're hard. They're a little fleshy. They're fleshy, but they're hard. Caterpillars and the little fleshy growths that look like mashed potatoes sort of aren't at all related. Completely different things.
All right.
So the caterpillars were probably early in the year are probably harmless. You'll get some caterpillars later on that are a problem, but probably not a big deal with those caterpillars. So let's forget the caterpillars for the time being. What you're looking at is it's not really a cancer either. It's a fungal growth that sometimes develops. It's a response to a fungus that infects certain types of leaves, and it gets in and it creates a gall, a G-A-L-L. Have you ever heard of a gall? You ever heard people talk about galls? What you're looking at is a gall, and galls really don't do a lot of damage. I mean, they look funky, they look funny, and they look kind of spooky, but they actually are not such a big deal. And azaleas have lots of galls this time of year. Sometimes it'll be the flower buds that turn into galls. I've seen flowers turn into galls. I've seen leaves turn into galls.
Well, do I need
and
to go
mostly
off?
What you're seeing now is probably young leaves that are turning into galls that are infected by this fungus. The fungus is creating probably a fungus. It could be an insect. Creating this little environment in which it can live, but it's not doing a lot of harm to the plant, and it's not really a problem. You can pick them off if you don't like them. You can pick them off and put them in a plastic bag and seal it up and put it in the garbage can, and there will be some and there's that means there'll be less of a chance that you'll see any galls next year.
Okay, great, because these are not too old azaleas. They're
kind of young.
Old.
Yeah, but it's I wouldn't worry about the azaleas at all. It's just an appearance thing, and it kind of gives you the willies.
Yes,
and because it gives you the willies, I'd say pick them off, put them in a plastic bag, seal it up, put it in the garbage can, and maybe you won't see it again next year.
All right, now I wanted to say something else. You know, for babies, they have these packets. They have little boxes in it, and it's rice and barley, and I think wheat and something else. So if you can feed them to your baby, you know, so you rotate like four or five different kinds of flavors, and so it's not like just feeding them rice all the time for your little baby.
That's right.
So that's something I think they've tried to do. All right, well, I appreciate it so much. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you. Yeah, and Wanda's got a great point. You know, one of the most important things, by cycling through a lot of different types of foods, you limit the dangers that are posed with that may be posed with any one type, and so it's good to have a variety of grains in your diet, and that's one of the things that packet does. It would be better if we hadn't contaminated our rice fields, but given the fact that there is a little bit of contamination, a little bit of problems with everything, it's sometimes good to cycle through different things. Catherine, what's up?
Oh, hey, Bill.
How are you? How are you?
I'm fine. I'm great. It's a beautiful day, and yesterday I was out spreading cottonseed meal around, and I got my lemons, and I got to the fig tree, and I thought, I think I've heard something about not feeding figs. Is that right?
Yeah. So let me tell you why I never feed a fig if I can help it. They grow, if they're happy, they grow like crazy, and they get too big too fast. If you feed a fig, it doesn't increase the flower production. It mostly increases the leaf production.
Okay.
So the truth is I never fertilize my figs. Now, they probably get accidental fertilization because they got roots all over creation. So they're stealing some fertilizer from my garden beds, and they're stealing some fertilizer from my bananas, and stealing fertilizer from my citrus. But the figs themselves usually don't need a lot of fertilizer. The only thing that I think figs really need, and they really need this in our climate, is a deep mulch of leaves. If you've got a deep mulch of leaves that stretches out as far as the canopy, That'll be the happiest fig in the world. It'll have all of the nutrients it ever needs. It won't have nematodes, which are a big problem because the mulch will help suppress the nematodes. And it'll have the organic matter that it really loves. So the only thing I recommend for figs is really a big dose of organic matter in the form of leaves, as far around, thick leaves as far around that fig as you can possibly put them.
Okay. All right, we can do that.
Yeah, and I can't think of any way to make growing figs more complicated than that, other than once they're happy, they're going to grow really fast, so you're going to have to cut them back.
Yeah.
And when you in order to get to the figs, so
okay.
That's it.
All right. Well, we did that last in the winter. We did.
Yeah.
My husband did that. All right. I have one other real quick question. We have
a
compost pile that we didn't turn it over ever, and then we moved on to a different one, and we've been trying to get some stuff out of that compost pile, and it's kind of all bound up.
That's right. So, yeah, so there it is. That's why I always, so, yes. It's kind of bound up. It's probably most of it's that compost pile, where you've got that compost pile, if you could grow something right there, it's going to be very happy because it's all already bound up. It's already in the soil. Everything that was a benefit from that compost pile went right underneath the compost pile.
Uh-huh. Okay.
This is one of the reasons I say, I put your compost pile where you want to grow plants.
Okay.
See what I'm saying? So we'll come back and talk about that.
Okay.
Put it right where you want to grow your tomatoes next year. Boom, you're going to have great tomatoes.
All right, okay.
All right. Thanks, Catherine. Thanks for calling.
You can take all the tea in China. Put it in a big brown bag for me. Sail right round all the seven oceans. Drop it straight into the deep blue sea. She's as sweet as Tupelo honey.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Do I get to follow up on the advice I gave to Catherine? Because it's good for everybody to hear. So Catherine built a compost pile away from her garden and didn't turn it. Now, you know, actually, in our climate, you can get by without turning a compost pile. It's okay. Actually, I've done that a lot of times. In particular, if you just layer it right, it'll be fine. It'll take a little longer maybe, but it'll be fine. The primary reason for turning is to oxygenate. But here's the interesting problem. As that's decomposing, all of the good stuff from that compost is going straight into the ground underneath because there's a lot of activity that goes on before this compost stuff that we talk about is removed from the compost pile. So most of the good stuff from that compost has already gone into the ground. It's already been moved into the ground rapidly because we have very active soil creatures like earthworms and everything else. They're already moving it into the soil. So the key to understanding how to do compost in our climate is to put it where you want to grow things. Don't put a compost pile and stick it off in some corner of the yard where you'll never grow anything because, yeah. Now, if you got a big leaf pile and it's 6 or 7 or 8 feet high and you want to put it over there just for a little while and then move it onto the garden at the right time, that's one thing. But put your compost pile in your garden. That's where you always want your compost pile. I keep trying to think of an area, of an instance, in which you wouldn't want to do that, and I can't think of one, or in which you couldn't do that. Just put your compost pile where you want your garden to be. That's the way to do it. So here's what I do. Tomatoes being the most difficult of all creatures, in our Gulf Coast climate. And you have to be extra nice to them. And sometimes I think, gosh, you guys aren't worth it. But sometimes I think you're worth it. So I'm going to be extra nice to you. How do I do that? I make my compost pile right where I'm going to put those tomatoes. So if I've got 5 tomatoes, let's say 16 feet of row, 16 feet of garden, that's about right. 3 feet per plant, about 16 feet, a 16-foot row, 3 feet wide for each for 5 tomatoes. Okay, let's just say that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that whole row and I'm going to pile them up with leaves. And then I'm going to come back and pile the kitchen scraps on top of that. And then more leaves and kitchen scraps on top of that. And I'll start that in fall or in summer and fall where I want to grow the tomatoes next year. And that bed is going to be a great place for me to grow tomatoes next year. I won't have any weeds. I won't have any problems. I won't have to dig. I mean, the soil will be so rich where that is. It's incredible how that works. So that's what I'm saying. When you want to do the composting, do it where your beds are. And they don't have to be just a little square. You can make a nice big area. You know, if you haven't ever started a bed in a place, and I'm going to do this year. Let me go on for just 1 second. You're just starting a bed this year. You don't want to do a lot of digging. Go through where you want that bed to be. Let's say it's another 3 by 15 bed, 3 feet by 15 feet. Just crack that bed with your fork. Take a fork, put it in, crack the soil underneath. Don't try to separate the weeds out. Don't turn it upside down. Don't do anything except just put your fork in there, crack that hard pan. Just crack that bed. That's all you're doing, just cracking it, not turning it. You don't want to turn anything. The grass or whatever else will still be on top. Then take your leaves and everything and put it right on top of that and pile it up, 4 or 5 feet high. It'll kill all the grass underneath it. You'll never have to weed that grass out. You'll never have to pull a stem of grass. You won't have to do anything except maybe add a little bit of lime just before planting, and you might have to add a little bit of nitrogen. It's so easy to start a bed that way. It is one of the easiest things you've ever done. Very easy. Control your weeds and deal with that. So, Geraldine, I'm listening. What's up?
Okay, I have what looks like a great compost pile for my garden. It's about a foot deep, and I have 3 loads of ground up wood chips and leaves dumped in it about 3 years ago. Last year I climbed it and a couple other things, and it looks great. And I haven't planted anything in it yet, and I'm only planning on planting what I know I can grow: cucumbers and okra and eggplants. Here's what my question is: digging around in it yesterday, it looks great. It's got mushrooms and that white growth in it,
Yeah.
But I found a lot of black army ants, and I don't know whether they're eating what the plants is going to need. Should I put spinosad on them and try to kill them? Should I ignore them, or what should I do before I start dropping seeds in there?
Well, those black ants are what we call lockjaw ants, they're very different than fire ants. They're less they don't crawl all over you like fire ants do, and they don't leave pustules or anything, but they pinch. Boy, do they pinch! And as long as you don't get pinched by those fire ants, they're not going to bother your plants at all. They're not fire ants.
Well, what are they eating? Why are they there?
Well, there's a lady that's a hard question. So they're there because I guess because God put them there. That's a good question.
Okay.
They're there because they do tend to where there's a high organic matter content and lots of space in the ground between wood particles, for example. Where I've seen decomposing wood, I see these ants. The ants aren't actually eating the wood. They're probably tending to, they're probably using the wood as a substrate, and they may be eating things that are associated with the wood, like some of the fungi, But here's the thing. They're harmless. They won't hurt your plants at all. They actually will keep the fire ants out of those beds, which is very nice. So they are antagonistic to fire ants.
Well, I'm glad to know that because I've been worried about, well, this would be one big fire ant bed if I don't watch it. So I've been nervous about that. So that was worth calling you for you to tell me that.
That's right.
One more question about bananas. Yeah. That cone or banana stump or whatever it is that you have in your bunch of banana trees, what do you do with that? Do you leave it alone? Do you cut it up at some point and remove it, or what is it?
The little cone at the tip of the bananas.
No, it's growing out of the ground where the banana trees, the old banana trees, has been.
Okay, you better describe this to me again. Start again, because I'm confused. I'll have to.
Okay, I got a group of Arnica bananas, and they've always been done great. But you know, when one of them has bananas, that stump dies or cut it down or whatever, and you got this. I don't know the true name of it. I call it a cone, a cone. It's like a stump. That's growing in. It's not hurting anything, but I'm just wondering: should I leave it there, or cut it, dig it up, or does it serve a purpose?
No.
It's coming out of the ground. It's not coming out of banana trees.
Yeah, no. Just leave that alone. That's the old stump from the old trunk. Just leave it be. It'll rot out, and it will provide nutrients to the rest of the clump as it does. So no, you're fine.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Geraldine. Thank you. So that's good. That's interesting. You know, these lockjaw ants are really interesting ants. And every now and then I'll let one bite me just so I'll remember what it's like. It is an experience. It's an experience. The initial peck is a real, Boy, it's sharp, it's fast, it's hot. And then it lasts about 3 seconds and it's gone. So that's an interesting thing. The lockjaw ants don't bother me a lot. I don't think people get reactions to them because it's more like a pinch than it is a poison, as nearly as I can tell. Never get a pustule associated with it. But a lot of people will see these lockjaw ants in our beds. It's, you know, I still have not been able to answer the question, are these native or introduced? I think they're native to us, but they thrive around old houses, particularly around wood. They don't actually eat wood. A lot of people worry about them eating wood. Ants don't actually eat wood. They will eat really decomposed. They might use decomposed woods to make nest out of. It's termites that eat wood, and it's the termites you need to worry about. So don't worry about the ants eating wood. It's the termites that you want to worry about. All right. Keith, you didn't think it was, you thought it's crazy for me so I can remember what, well, it is. You know, you think, did that really hurt the way I thought it hurt? And then you just do it again, and it, okay. There it is. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Bill, yes, you are crazy for letting ants intentionally bite you.
Yes.
Anyway, real quickly, I was surveying where my raised flower beds are planning out the reconstruction process, and I discovered that two of my blueberry bushes in my backyard survived the wrath of Samson. If I wanted to move them to the front yard, would it be best just to basically dig them up and move them, or to move them into a pot for a while, or what?
No, it would be a bad idea to move them into a pot in general, I think, because if you're gonna remember to water them in the pot, you'll remember to water them in the ground. Just make sure when you move them into the new spot of ground that you water them as much in the ground as you would have if they were in the pot, and then it'll be easier to manage.
All right,
go
now
ahead.
How far
and move
out
them.
Do I need to go to dig them up to do the least amount of damage to the root system? One is about a foot and a half to 2 feet tall, and one is less than a foot tall.
Yeah, you know, they probably don't have much root system, David. I would go out 18 inches from each plant, and that should be sufficient. 18 inches from the center of each plant. So that way you're getting a 3-foot ball, if you see what I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
A, a, and that's about as big as you'll be able to handle easily. Slip some, you're going to lose a lot of that soil in the process. Try to slip something underneath it. I will also tell you, David, if you can wait until fall, you'll have better success. But if you do it now, you'll still be okay as long as you remember to water.
All right, sounds good.
All right, good to hear from you, David. We got to take a break, obviously. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, we got to play lightning round here. Because we got a lot of questions we got to answer. We're going to do them as quickly as we can. Is it too late for nasturtiums? Yes, I think it is. They just don't like the hot weather. I would hold on to those seeds and plant them this September. That's a great time, or even late August, and that way they'll be ready to flower and look really good. They'll look really good in October, November, December. You can overwinter them in pots. A little late for nasturtiums now. Chris over in Pace is asking me what kind of tree that is. Well, that's a paulownia tree. It's a tree from Asia. Does it have another name? I'm trying to think. Let's just call it paulownia. I'll have to remember exactly how you spell it, but paulownia. It's pretty close. I think that's about right. Paulownia. It's a tree from Asia. It's kind of a funky tree. It's kind of pretty. It's kind of invasive in some places. It's not bad on the Gulf Coast, though. It doesn't live a long time on the Gulf Coast, but it's not as bad as invasive as it is. Dan, you're going to have to wait till next week and ask me that question again next week. We'll talk a little bit more about soil. Billy Bob, of course, that's too thick for good banana growth. Absolutely. We got a caller here who's showing me a little tree, a woody ornamental in my yard. I don't know what it is. It's beautiful. It's got these orange flowers with red tubes all over it. Well, that's our nice honeysuckle azalea. That is an azalea. That's one of our native azaleas. That's a hybrid of one of our native azaleas. I expect it's a beautiful thing. That is an azalea. In the old days, we used to call those honeysuckles. They're not at all related to the honeysuckle vine that's taken over. That's from Japan, a very different kind of thing. This is what we call, let's call them honeysuckle azaleas. It's a beautiful thing. That's what that little thing is that you've got there. Greg, yeah, those little worms on the tomatoes are certainly a problem. They're southern army worms. It's time to do something about those southern army worms. I would get them. They will eat your young tomatoes. Pick off the ones that you see now and go ahead and start using BT in the form of Thuricide or Dipel. It's a bacterial disease that affects only caterpillars. It's very effective. I would go ahead and start spraying once a week, Greg, or once every 10 days to control those worms, and you'll be able to control those army worms. We got a caller. I'm listening. What's up? Clyde, what's up?
Mr. Finch, good morning. I've got a lemon tree that's 5 years old, and it had prolific blooms on it about a month ago, but it started losing its leaves.
Yeah, so is it in a container?
No, sir.
It's in the ground.
It's in the ground.
I think it's probably okay. So a lot of times citrus, is it losing all of its leaves or just some of its leaves?
Just some of its leaves.
Yeah, so every evergreen plant loses leaves. We call them evergreens, but that's not true. They actually are losing leaves all the time. And sometimes, you know how live oaks, every spring, there'll be this embarrassing moment for the live oaks, usually about 2 or 3 or 4 days, when they're almost completely naked because they'll shed all their leaves in March, and it'll take them a few days to put the new leaves on. That's kind of, citrus will do the same thing as the seasons change, and you'll get a lot of leaf loss, but I think it's okay. The only thing I would worry about is if for any reason your soil was too wet, But this is not a year your soil would be too wet, even on Cypress Shores. I mean, I think we would have seen it at some other time. So I'm thinking it's just natural leaf drop in spring, and it's putting on some new leaves. Everything's going to be fine.
Sounds great. You have a good day.
You too. So that's always good when I can say, yeah, don't worry. Is it okay to just say, yeah, don't worry? Sometimes it's okay not to worry. Greg, this Dipel, Thuricide is another name for the product. There are two product names, Dipel and Thuricide. Mostly what we see around here tends to be a product called Thuricide, T-H-U-R-I-C-I-D-E. It sounds like some dangerous toxic chemical, I know. But actually, it's not. It is a very safe product. It's a very smart product. A few years ago, people figured out, look, there's a way we can take this disease, this bacterial disease that affects only caterpillars, and we can put it in a little spray and a little bottle, and you can spray it on your plants, and the caterpillars eat it, and they get the disease, and they die. It's great. Humans don't get caterpillar diseases, as it turns out, surprisingly enough. So the same bacteria don't infect humans. In fact, they don't really infect anything else except for caterpillars. That's what Bacillus thuringiensis, whichever one it is, Kuristaki or whoever, that's what it's all about, is just infecting that particular creature. And so BT is a nice, smart product. And those army worms can drive you crazy. Oh, gosh, I hate it. Army worms are the most annoying of all, and they'll get, you know, they feed on just about everything. They're there all year long in our climate. It's just one of the problems. But, Greg, BT's the thing to do. Go ahead and start using it now so you won't have such a problem, so you won't be so annoyed. I highly recommend it. Oh, man. So, you know, we just barely got started. We just barely got started on the subject of soil this morning. I wish we had talked more about it. Next week we're going to talk a little bit more about it and what soil means, what good soil is about. It's a really great question, because we're always thinking, oh, you can buy soil in a bag, or you can go to the store and buy topsoil. But that's, you, oh boy, you've missed the point. And you know, folks, when you buy compost, one of the mistakes we make is thinking, oh, well, this needs to be all broken down. But it's the breaking down process that benefits your soil. It's the process of having it break down that's good. You don't want to miss that. So start with the raw ingredients of the compost, because that's what those soil creatures eat. That's where the benefits come from. When you go to the dump and you get something that's completely broken down, well, that helps a little bit, but it's not really what you're looking for. Folks, I gotta go. It was good. We'll be back next week.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on, tell me, baby. In the pond, where the sun don't ever shine. I was shivering all night too. My girl, where will you go? I'm going where the cold wind blows. Where's that, baby? In the pines, where the sun don't ever shine. I bet you will do all night too. My girl, don't you lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on in.
something about it.